I think my talk, the talks so far have been really good and very interesting. And I think that my talk is going to sort of turn things on its head a little bit in the sense that we've been hearing a lot about genetic diversity among populations in the landscape. And what I'm going to focus in on today is actually phenotypic diversity among populations in the landscape and how that might lead us to ask some questions about genetic diversity in what we plan on doing in the future. So the phenotype that I'm interested in is body size, as my title implies here. And so I thought it would be worth reminding ourselves why we think body size is a really important trait to study. We often hear this quote that body size is the most fundamental trait of any organism, but I think as biologists sometimes we forget exactly why we believe this is true. And from my perspective anyways, it really has to do with the two sides of this figure here. On the left-hand side, we have what I've labeled intrinsic mechanisms, intrinsic to the organism, and extrinsic conditions, that is the ecological or environmental conditions that animals find themselves in. And those mechanisms and conditions really are the generators of variation in adult size. So these are within generation production of variation in adult size. Then on the right-hand side of the figure, what we have is the consequences for that variation, how adult size then plays out in terms of reproduction, survivorship, and those things. And then, of course, that feeds back into whether or not we see adaptation and natural selection. So it's really those two sides of the figure, the within-generation production of size variation, and then the cross-generational effects that I think make body size a really important trait to study. Okay. So it's an important trait. I think I've convinced you of that. The question now is, what does it mean if we go out into the wild and we see some spatial variation in the average adult body size among different populations? What, in fact, does that tell us? Well, I think the first thing that comes to your mind is that these extrinsic conditions that I mentioned earlier might vary across the landscape. And we have some information on our study system but about the extrinsic conditions, but I'm not going to talk about those today. We could talk about them in the question session later. What I really want to focus in on today are the fact that irrespective of what those extrinsic conditions are, one or more of those intrinsic mechanisms probably varies across the landscape, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. And then, again, independent of the within-generation effects, the extrinsic conditions or the intrinsic mechanisms, you can ask two questions. First, it may be that populations are adapted to the local conditions that they find themselves in. Okay, so that if you went out into the wild and you actually measured the strength of selection in multiple populations, some populations' selection should favor large body sizes and some populations' selection should be favoring small body sizes if adaptation is occurring. On the other hand, what you might do is you might find that in fact the populations are exhibiting some sort of plastic response to the environments that they're in. In other words, if you brought the animals into the lab and reared them in a common lab environment, the differences that you see in the wild would actually be eliminated or at least reduced greatly in a common environment. So, given that, I wanted to talk about the system that we've been working on, which is the lubber grasshoppers, Romalia microptera. These are relatively large grasshoppers found throughout the southeastern United States, and our study sites are located in South Florida, and I'll show you a picture of those in a minute. The bottom picture there is a picture of two females from two different populations, so you can already see some of the size variation. The females oviposit from June to August, and they lay their eggs in the ground. And up in the left-hand corner, what you see is an egg pod, that dark area, in an egg cup in the lab, and that'll be important here in a minute. But the eggs stay in the ground from whenever they're laid, June, July, August, until the following March, at which point they hatch out into the nymphal stage, and they go through five nymphal instars. This is the primary growth stage of the organism. This is when it's putting on a large portion of its mass and all of its external size. So remember that once it metamorphoses to the adult stage, the exoskeleton becomes hard, and if you take measurements of that exoskeleton at one point in time and release the animal and come back, that size doesn't change. All right, so how does the size variation play out in the field? This is a Google Earth image of South Florida. So north is up, just to orient yourself here. And you can see in the bottom half is the Everglades, and the top half is Big Cypress. And each one of those white points represents a population that we have sampled. And you can see, I have it labeled here, as you go from the western field sites to the eastern field sites, the average body size of adults becomes gradually larger and larger. And that's what the data figure down there in the bottom right represents. We have adult pronotum length on the y-axis. And then notice the x-axis, because you're going to see this x-axis a couple more times. What I have here is the degrees longitude from west to east. So I just set the westernmost population to zero and calculated the degrees longitude east for all the other populations. And you can see in both years, there's a significant increase in the average adult body size. The exact relationship differs among years, but it increases in both years. Okay, so we have this size variation. The question now is, what are the intrinsic mechanisms that might produce this size variation among the different populations? And what evidence do we have for adaptation as opposed to plasticity? So I'm going to focus first on these intrinsic mechanisms, specifically talking about initial size, or in this case, hatching size, development time, and growth rate, and how these might produce the pattern that we see in adult size. Of course, if you have two populations and one population has large hatchlings and the other population has relatively small hatchlings, if everything else is equal, the population with large hatchlings should produce large adults. Similarly, if you have two populations with differences in development time, the population with the longer development time should produce larger adults, again, everything else being equal. And the same is true for growth rate. The populations with higher growth rates or putting on more mass per unit time should produce larger adults than populations that have lower growth rates. So we predicted that one or more of these mechanisms would differ among the populations. Now, it's just not simple enough that they differ, but in fact they have to differ in a way that produces the spatial pattern that we see in adult size in order to be a mechanism underlying this. So we predict that either hatchling size is smaller, or juvenile development time is shorter, or the growth rate of individuals is lower in western relative to eastern populations, or some combination of these three things. The nice thing about these grasshoppers is that they have this great behavior that at the end of the day, they get tired, I guess, and they climb to the tops of the plants and they sit there overnight. So that if you come first thing in the morning, which is when this photograph was taken, with your hand net, you can just walk along and shake off a whole bunch of animals into your hand net and have a relatively large sample size in a pretty short period of time. So that makes them pretty easy to work with in that respect. You got your sample, and we can take a number of size measures, pronotum and femur lengths. So these are measures of the exoskeleton as well as mass. We can sex the animals, get their developmental stage, and we can also calculate their growth rates. And for the purposes of this talk, growth rate is going to be the log 10 mass of the fourth instar divided by the duration from the first to the fourth instar. And the reason I stop at the fourth instar is because I have the best estimates for the durations of instars 1 through 4. And we have to estimate those instar durations from our field samples using a method known as the a K&M method for instar frequency data. If you're not familiar with this method, it basically just calculates the area under the time instar frequency curve, and then you can get the estimated lengths of instars in terms of days in this case. It makes three basic assumptions. One, that survival rate is constant across the stages, and we do believe that that holds. It also makes some assumptions about when sampling starts and ends, and so that's just a matter of us making sure we sample at the right times. And then it also makes the assumption that there's no migration in or out of the populations. And at this point, we have no evidence to suggest otherwise. So, okay, so let's look at some of the data. Starting with hatchling size. What we did for hatchling size was we captured females in the wild from three different populations, let them lay eggs in those egg cups that I showed you earlier, brought the egg cups back to the lab, let them hatch out in the lab, and then just measured their, in this case, mean pronotum length. And so we have data for three populations. Those are the three points there. Again, our x-axis is degrees longitude. And you can see that it does not fit the pattern that we expect, right? That really, hatchling size doesn't vary, at least among these three populations. Contrast that with juvenile development time. Here we have the duration of instar 1 in days on the y-axis and our longitude on the x-axis. And I'm showing you data from the 2 years, 2006 and 2007, for the females. I combined the years because they were not significantly different from each other. But there is a significant positive slope here, so that the duration of the first instar in the western population seems to be relatively shorter than it is in the eastern population. So this does fit what you might expect if juvenile development time were operating. Similarly, we got a pattern that also fits what you might expect for growth rate. Again, the females are shown here for the 2 years combined, and there's a significantly higher growth rate in in eastern populations relative to western populations. So what do we know so far? Well, this decline seems to hold over a couple of years. I showed you data for 2 years. We actually have data for a third year, but not from all the populations, so it wasn't included in that analysis. But it seems to hold over time, which is good. However, it doesn't seem like hatchling size is contributing to the pattern that we see, but it's very possible that juvenile development time and the growth rate, particularly of females, might contribute. These may be the intrinsic mechanisms that are contributing to the pattern that we see. Okay, so we have some idea about how size variation is being produced in the adult stage. Can we detect any consequences for that variation in terms of reproduction and the potential for adaptation? So what do we need to know? Well, for adaptation, what we would like to know is, first of all, if there's any variation in the trait, and I think I've adequately demonstrated that there is, and so I've put a check mark next to that. But the question still remains, is size a heritable trait? And second of all, is there is selection operating on size? In other words, is there a relationship between size and fitness? And then finally, we'd like to know if, in fact, there is any relationship between, or excuse me, if there's any response to a common environment when we bring the animals into a common environment. Do we see any plastic response? So in order to get at heritability and the response to a common environment, what we did was we reared those animals that we hatched out in the lab, reared them in a common environment to the adult stage, and we had measures, of course, of the adult parents, and then we measured the adult offspring of those parents and regressed the mid-offspring size against the mid-parent size to get a measure of heritability. And then to look at the response to the common environment, we just examined the differences among the populations when they were reared in this common environment. Now, to get the relationship between size and fitness, for females, what we did was we took fifth instar females from the wild, and we got fifth instars because we knew that they would be virgins, and reared them in the lab throughout their adult life and let them lay eggs. And this was without mating, so they'll lay eggs even if they're not mated. We just wanted to know the relationship between female size and in this case, number of eggs laid without any male contribution. And then for males, what we did was we sampled four populations in the wild and looked at copulation success and regressed that against body size. Okay, so in terms of heritability, pronotum length heritability, pronotum length appears to be heritable. However, the heritability doesn't differ among the three sites that we tested, so the sites are represented by different shapes. You can see that females hatch out, females are larger than males, which is why the open symbols are above the solid symbols in this figure. But there was no interaction between sex and site and mid-parent pronotum length. So it does look like pronotum is heritable. However, femur, which I'm not showing you here, femur length did not show a heritable component, at least from this kind of an analysis. The question then is there a plastic response? And in fact, we did find a plastic response. What I'm showing you here is female pronotum length on the y-axis for the three populations, a western, a central, and an eastern population. The lab-reared animals are shown in the open symbols, and the solid symbols are just the field-caught animals. So you can see in the field, they do differ, but in the lab, they in fact do not differ in body size. So there is a plastic response, and this was also true for femur length as well. Okay, so given that at least pronotum length shows some heritability, do we see any evidence for selection on body size? And the bottom line is, no, we don't, either direct or indirect selection. So, of course, the slope of the regression will give you the strength of selection, and the strength of direct selection is represented by the beta term in this table, and the strength of indirect selection is represented by the gamma symbol in this table, and you can see that it's zero. At least from this measurement, we do not see in either sex for either of these traits any relationship between size and these fitness characters. So, where does that leave us? Well, we have some phenotypic variation in the traits. We can show that at least pronotum length is heritable. However, there's a strong plastic response to a common environment, and there's no evidence for either direct or indirect selection. So we have some mechanisms, but the causes at this point seem to be more a response to environmental conditions, a plastic response to environmental conditions, rather than selection on body size per se. Now, that doesn't mean that selection isn't operating on one of these mechanisms, for example, or the other possibility here is that, in fact, there may be selection on plasticity for body size, and that's something that we would like to investigate in the future. So, getting back to the beginning here, local adaptation versus plasticity. Right now, things are favoring plasticity. However, what we'd like to do is go back and examine at least one of the prerequisites for local adaptation to occur, and that is minimal gene flow between populations. Adaptation, for local adaptation to occur, you have to have relatively low gene flow among these populations. The interesting thing here is that the flip side of that is that plasticity seems to be favored in a metapopulation structure, and this was pointed out by Sultan and Spencer in a really nice modeling paper in the American Naturalist a few years ago. So we may actually have some sort of metapopulation going on here. This metapopulation structure, according to Sultan and Spencer, seems to favor plasticity even at relatively low levels of migration between these populations. So this is the next avenue of research that we're going to pursue using microsatellite and mitochondrial DNA. With that, I'd like to just acknowledge the students who've worked on this, a number of undergraduate students. This project is funded by NSF to get undergraduates involved in scientific research. And so that's basically been my job for the last couple of years. My collaborators and postdoc advisors, Steve Giuliano, Olje Ackman, Sabina Loof, Dave Borst, and Doug Whitman, and of course the landowners who have allowed us to work on their property. And with that, I don't know if we have any time for questions or not.
So we have time for questions now.
Carol.
Out of curiosity, do you know whether there's a correlation between the number of eggs and female relay and she's not mated and what she'll
make? No, we do not know that. Yeah, that's a good question.
Actually,
oh, we do know this?
The female doesn't change significantly whether she's mated or not.
Oh, okay.
There's a slight.
That's cool.
Well, the eggs are inviolable.
Yeah, I know, but it's cool that you can measure that
way. There's a delay in egg laying which is not mated.
Okay. Yeah.
Did you keep the resources the same when you brought them in the lab as far as forbs or grasses?
No, we reared them in the lab on romaine lettuce. So it was not the same as.
We did the same thing online instead of their natural. In Texas, they're eating mostly roadside grasses and stuff like that. So
right.
They the same kind of.
Yeah, they do the same in Florida as well. Andy.
Do you know anything about predation across that gradient?
Oh, I didn't mention this, but there really aren't any or very many vertebrate predators because they're poisonous. But there are invertebrate predators I've noticed in the field the last couple of years. Now, we haven't measured that yet, but that's something that we're thinking about, yeah.
Is there some type of resource gradient across this?
Yeah, we've been trying to get at that. In terms of host plants, there really aren't that many differences. There are some differences among the sites, but they don't follow the body size pattern that we see. So we don't think at this point that host plants are involved. There is some climactic differences among the populations that do follow this is South Florida, you wouldn't think there are, but there are some temperature differences that might be involved here that could be at play, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know about how Okeechobee and those kinds of hydrological gradients, but there are some precipitation gradients along that east to west pattern, and how they play out is something we're still thinking about. It seemed to me, if I remember correctly on this, Steve, the eastern sites were wetter, eastern sites were wetter than the western sites.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's time of the year. Yeah.
I think it was the spring, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Are the prevailing winds westerly? Do they come from the Gulf and blow? Because I would think Florida.
That I don't.
More affected by prevailing winds blowing west.
That I'm not sure about the prevailing winds, but one thing I guess I forgot to mention is that these are flightless. So that's why, this is why I should have set this up at the beginning, because that's why we were looking at local adaptation, and we sort of had our mindset on this, and we're surprised to see the plasticity, so.
Yeah.